The Obama administration is asking for $3.7 billion in emergency funds from Congress to address the flood of unaccompanied children coming illegally into the U.S. What's driving the crisis? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll also talk about the politics behind this influx of children at our southern border and how it relates to the long-standing immigration debate. Also, analysis on the latest developments in the Middle East, Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, and the disputed presidential election in Afghanistan. Our guests this hour, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. Politics inside and outside our borders, after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday has arrived. Great to have you with us and great to have our guest this week. Jim McCormick is with us, professor of political science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing fine. Thank you for asking. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College by phone. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing very well. And with both of your expertise, we love to look not only at politics within, but without outside our borders this hour. I want to talk a little bit about the problem going down on the south of our border that has to do with our immigration debate in just a minute, but also later on, the Middle East violence, also Iraq, turmoil in Iraq, in Syria, Afghanistan, Ukraine, and no deficit of turmoil around the world and politics to go with it to talk about this week. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let's jump in with the border situation, gentlemen. The Obama administration is asking for $3.7 billion in emergency funds from Congress to address the flood of unaccompanied children coming illegally into the United States. President Obama is in Texas today. He's in the Lone Star State to raise money at two different fundraisers, one in Dallas and one in Austin. But he won't be going to the U.S.-Mexico border to inspect what his administration has called a humanitarian crisis. Now, Texas Governor Rick Perry, in an interview with Fox and Friends, called on President Obama to come to the border to see the immigration crisis firsthand and accused the president of creating the crisis.
The real issue from my perspective is this message that has come out of this administration for too many years that come on up and cross the border and you can become a United States citizen.
At a White House briefing, spokesman Josh Earnest said it was hard to take Governor Perry's comments seriously, but the White House is taking the situation very seriously.
There is an urgent humanitarian situation that needs to be dealt with, and you've seen a very proactive response from the federal government. And what we'd like Congress to do is to act with the same sense of urgency and make sure that this administration has all of the necessary resources to deal with the situation.
Jim McCormick, explain a little bit about the politics behind this crisis that we're here bubbling up in those cuts.
Well, I think what we have here is that this flood of, frankly, refugees from Central America, I mean, the numbers have been put at, since last October, something like 52,000 here. And of course, the split in the United States across the political spectrum is that, you know, Republicans have really demanded for some time that there be greater border security and that just simply responding to the humanitarian situation, as the president's spokesperson suggested, will not stop the real problem in terms of these refugees coming to the United States. On the other hand, the administration and its Democratic allies are obviously concerned about really being responsive to the immigrant population and to particular Hispanics who they see as part of their political base. So they don't want to necessarily alienate them by too strong measures of on the border. So You know, it is a bit of a standoff here, and it's even reflected in the comments by Speaker Boehner saying that the administration haven't taken them up on securing the border, and so they're sort of, at least at this juncture, kind of slow walking this $3.7 billion request from the administration.
Mm-hmm. That is the talk from the Republicans. I wonder, Wayne Moyer, is that really what's been happening? Has the Obama administration been lax on border control?
I don't think that the border control is the principal issue. One, I would agree with Jim. There's an awful lot of domestic politics that's getting into this. I see the Republicans as trying to sort of appeal to their anti-immigration base, and Obama is trying to thread a very thin line between antagonizing the immigrant community inside the United States on one side, on the other side being tough enough that swing voters who might be concerned about immigration would be pulled away from the Democratic Party. But the underlying issues, there are a whole bunch of them. Most of these kids are coming from countries that have a lot of domestic violence. And then there is a congressional act that was passed at the end of the Bush administration, the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which essentially was trying to stop child trafficking and immigrants coming into the country from not Mexico but from Central America, then had to, before they were sent back, had to have a hearing with counsel and turned over to the Health and Human Protection. That created an sort of a byproduct of the law, an unintended byproduct that increased the attractiveness of coming to the United States.
But Wayne, that is a reauthorization in the waning days of the Bush presidency in December of 2008. We have 2014. Why 6 years later, suddenly a wave of children?
I think it takes a long time for the message to get fully out. And then you have a number of people in Latin America who are trying to make money by escorting kids over the border. I think a large part of it is it takes a while for these messages to develop. It's coming to a head right now.
Jim McCormick, each side taking its crack at explaining what is behind this wave of young immigrants. How do you see it?
Well, I would agree with Wayne. It takes some time for this. I suspect what has happened is, and under this act that Wayne referenced, the Congress actually should get a yearly report from the administration. I took a look at the act this morning, the legislation, and the Congress should be aware of how many immigrants that there have been, or these illegal immigrants, I guess, to be more precise here, that have been coming across. So I suspect what has happened is that there has been no response or limited response or this kind of delay in not turning back any of these young immigrant or younger folks that had come in. And this has created this kind of flood, as well as the increased violence. I mean, Honduras and Guatemala have experienced lots of internal violence. And so I suspect that also accelerated this kind of wave. And the coyotes here, are making, the numbers are sort of astronomical. If they really charge $5,000 a piece for safe passage across the Rio Grande, they're obviously, this is a very lucrative kind of trade for them.
Mm-hmm. Refugees was a word used, I think, Wayne.
Refugees.
Oh, and you too, Jim. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees says these people from those countries are subject to persecution. They say people entering the U.S. and nearby countries illegally from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras should not be forced to return home and should be treated as refugees. So we've got an international component here. We are not used to hearing illegal immigrants, undocumented workers, whatever you want to call them, being called refugees, are we?
We're really not. And I think that, this obviously in terms of the Obama administration wanting to at least give some deference to international law here and the UN, I think that they would be very reluctant to take any more sort of stringent action here. So I think Wayne really put it best. I mean, you really got these swing voters in the United States that are probably a little bit skeptical. I mean, we've seen these demonstrations in California and so on. They're a little bit skeptical, or maybe a lot skeptical, but yet also those are very important voters in the upcoming election, as well as the base of both of the parties having considerably different views. So I think, immigration is the classic kind of, as we talk about in political science, intermestic issues. You know, it's got this international component,
yes,
but it's also got this really strident, at least from my point of view, this domestic component that makes policymaking very, very difficult in the foreign policy arena.
Yeah, I could just add one little thing. I think it's very difficult for the UN to get into this because giving asylum is indeed a sovereign responsibility of nation states. And whether the U.S. accepts immigrants or not is not something that the international community can dictate to the United States.
Let's go to John in Iowa City. John, joining our conversation as we talk mostly international and this straddling issue of immigration this hour, 1-866-780-9100. John in Iowa City, welcome to our program.
Thank you. I really appreciate the comments that Jim and Wayne and you have made. And I also appreciate the use of the word refugees. They are fleeing really desperate social conditions in Guatemala and other Central American countries, and they're being taken advantage of. And I don't think enough conversation is there's not enough talk about those social conditions and what international, the United Nations and many private and other aid agencies can do. Of course, it's a very difficult thing, and we can't take care of the, it's very difficult. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, all of these groups have limited resources. But
John, if we better understood the social conditions behind this wave, how do you think that would change the debate here in the United States?
Well, would put more attention on the internal conditions of these countries. I was hearing on NPR a couple of mornings ago that, for example, not only there's grinding poverty and drug warfare, but there's a huge tendency for young girls 10 to 14 years old to have babies and multiple children. It's just a very difficult. It's like the inner cities of our country, actually. There's many underserved people in our country that are not, they're having a very difficult time, especially because there's many Republicans who are not only refusing to increase minimum wage, but wanting to do away with minimum wage. There's, growing poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Okay, John, thank you. I think we got the point. John calling from Iowa City. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Wayne or Jim reacting to that? Let me go back to the political aspect of this. The Washington Post commenting on this, the political side of this, which we've chewed over a little bit. The toxic environment on the Hill, combined with the looming midterm elections this fall, has contributed to the sense among Democrats and Republicans that a deal on emergency funding is unlikely, even though both sides say they agree with the White House that the crisis is urgent. So what happens if Republicans in the House, and they have the purse strings here, reject the White House's request for this $3.7 billion to respond to this crisis? Jim?
I think the politics of it is that they really cannot respond in some way to this humanitarian situation. I mean, I think that would be devastating. It would really open up a real avenue for Democrats in terms of the midterm election and further sort of make the point that somehow the Republicans are heartless. So I think what we're likely to see, and this is really the standoff, probably at a lower number, and probably in terms of some other program. I mean, to pay for this additional funding. But I can't imagine that the Republicans wouldn't respond in some way. I don't think they'll probably give the president additional authority, which he's requested. I'm not even sure that he needs it in terms of looking at that previous act that was referenced. There is some flexibility. There are some presidential waivers in there that he could use. So I think that's likely to be the standoff and likely to be the compromise that will eventuate.
One thing that is interesting at this stage is, who are you more concerned about in the election? Is it the sort of people who are really concerned about immigration, or are you concerned about the sort of changing demographics and the votes of legal immigrants who are now participating in the political process? And how this thing turns out will give some sense of where both sides are tilting on that.
Yeah, I mean,
balance.
There's a couple Senate races that really turn on the Hispanic vote. I mean, you think of Colorado, for example, and obviously the Republicans are concerned about picking up sufficient seats. They have to win, I think, 6 seats at least to take control of the Senate. So as Wayne says, that's a very, very tricky kind of balancing act that has to be handled.
Let's go to Paul in Des Moines. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I'm going to kind of just maybe even segue into from your last conversation. We've heard a little bit about what we think is going to happen in this upcoming election. If you were to look down the road, say 20 years, do you have a feel for how the way the different parties handle immigration, how do you think that'll change the political landscape? But I'm thinking of the civil rights movements in the 60s and how that changed the two parties.
Okay, Paul, thank you.
Thank you. And I'll hang up and just I'll listen to you, and thank you very much.
Paul's got a tall order from Des Moines. We have the crystal ball maybe going a few months or maybe a year into advance, but Paul is asking 15 or 20 years. Who would like to take a crack at that? Wayne?
It's hard to know. I'm not sure in terms of how the changing demographics will overall affect the country. Compared to the civil rights legislation of the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Their segregation was primarily in the South. The immigration problem is a national problem, and so I'm not quite sure how that will play out 20 years from now.
Okay, Jim McCormick, how's your long-term crystal ball?
Well, I'm going to just quote what Senator Graham, Lindsey Graham, said on a Sunday talk program this past Sunday. He says that the Republicans have no chance of winning the White House unless they do something about the immigration. They can't just have a policy of return of these folks back home. So I think that's sort of a starting point. I do think that the other thing that has to be taken into account here, and is a reapportionment. One of the things that has advantaged Republicans most recently in terms of the congressional races, and particularly on the House side, of course, is the reapportionment. And I think that is going to be sort of decisive over this 20-year period as well. I mean, certainly you have the Southwest in terms of Hispanic population, but Hispanics, I think, have now moved into the largest minority group within the country, and I think that is likely to be expanded. And it's obviously very important for both political parties to tap into that in terms of winning elections.
Aaron is with us. Hi, Aaron. Welcome to our program.
Oh, hi. Thank you very much. I have a question. And I'd preface it by saying that I didn't know anything about the immigration debate until I served in the U.S. Peace Corps in Guatemala from 2008 until 2010. During my service there, I quickly started to realize that the situation is what it is because specifically with Guatemala and actually many Central American countries, the coup d'etat that happened in the 1950s, deposing Arbenz Guzman, which led to a 36-year-long internal armed conflict. My question is, based on that, how does the United States still bear some sort of moral responsibility to let people in from those regions, considering, we are responsible for ousting a democratically elected leader at that time? And would the Republicans or anybody, you know, in Washington today really accept that as our responsibility and would it change the debate.
Okay, Aaron, thank you. Are those our chickens coming home to roost, Jim?
I think the memory is short here on these sorts of things here in terms of political activities and politicians on both sides. I mean, they're really worried about the next election. And I it's an interesting point, but I've not heard it really incorporated in any of the discussions. And, you know, the a kind of a guilt clause here for the past, I think that both parties would have a tough time managing that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's another factor operating here, too. People who are concerned about the immigration problem in general, that's on the forefront of their mind. And I think it's very hard for these sorts of people to go beyond that and think in terms of deeper causes and deeper responsibilities of the United States.
What about the theater that we've seen this week, though, and to the extent that each side is playing that? We have the president not wanting to go to the border with Governor Perry. We have Governor Perry refusing, turning down the request to meet the president on the tarmac for a photo op there. Who's winning public opinion, do you think, Jim?
Well, you know, I was actually surprised that the president did not take the opportunity to go to the border. Maybe he will yet. I don't know.
As far as I know, he's due to have a meeting late this afternoon.
In Dallas.
Dallas, yeah. With Governor Perry, also with what are called faith leaders, right?
Yeah, right. I just thought that he would do it. But after you sort of Governor Perry gave him kind of a mandate to go to the border, of course, he doesn't want to, I suspect, on a political level, he doesn't want to have to be really responsive to a governor of Texas in terms of his action. But it seems a little bit strange that, you know, he's in the vicinity. You know, it's sort of would give some comfort to local officials or even to the refugees by his presence there. So I'm a little bit surprised that he wouldn't take advantage of it. But on the other hand, he obviously doesn't want to be seen as being just taking a dictum from Governor Perry here. So I think that I think overall probably in my judgment, the president loses a little bit by not doing that.
Okay.
I think the other side of this, of course, is Obama's worried about sort of the media coverage. And if there's pictures of him looking across the border and it's portrayed as him being exceptionally tough on immigration, then I think that hurts him.
Okay. Yeah. Libby is with us from Sioux City. Hi, Libby. We've got just a minute before we have to break. Can you make it quick?
Sure. One of the things that I had concerns about was our programs within the United States are already stretched so thin. And now that we're allowing all the immigrants or refugees, as you say, to become have amnesty is what I'm understanding the president to be doing because of the lack of being able to ship the children back.
I don't think he's saying amnesty. Is he, Wayne?
No. It's simply time for a hearing to see whether, in fact, these kids were trafficked here or not. And the question is, how fast can the judicial process deal with this? It's a very time-consuming process.
Okay,
with
Libby,
lawyers
though.
Involved.
Yeah, Libby, the rest of your point before we have to go away for a break.
I'm just wondering, why haven't they just enforced the law? Why has the president disregarded the law on the books now and allowing all this to happen?
Okay, very quickly, Jim, a response there?
Well, I think that is it's a legitimate question. I mean, the president would say, of course, that he's returned more than the Bush administration. So he has been enforcing the law and he has been protecting the border.
Okay, we'll come back more with our show today, Politics Wednesday, looking at politics abroad and those straddling issues like immigration, border control. Jim McCormick is with us of Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College still to come. We'll look at the Middle East, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq, Ukraine, a lot to cover yet. We hope you'll stay by and join our conversation. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, picking apart the politics of recent days, mostly international this hour, but talking about immigration in the first half hour and the Obama administration's request for $3.7 billion in emergency funds from Congress to address the flood of unaccompanied children coming illegally to the United States. Thomas, writes in an email to us, if these children are going to be considered refugees, should all the responsibility fall on the United States? Would it be possible to work with other countries to relocate some of them? This way we aren't advertising citizenship for illegal immigrants and we aren't sending them back to a terrible situation. Jim McCormick, that's typical that the country adjacent to countries, I mean, these are coming from Central America. It's a few hundred miles, but we could share a refugee problem with other countries.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting idea. I guess you run into the same problem that you have some opposition within the United States. And given some of the countries with the kind of economic plight that they're facing, I'm not sure how readily acceptable that sort of solution might be. I mean, maybe our Canadian neighbors would be interested in that, you know, in terms of their economy has done a little bit better than the American economy.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the violence in the Middle East. Israeli aircraft carrying out strikes in the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian militants unleashing more rocket attacks against central Israel today as the battle between Hamas and Israel shows no signs of subsiding. Israel's Air Force, according to Wall Street Journal, reports attacking at least 160 targets in Gaza overnight, hitting what it said were militants, rocket launching sites, military equipment, smuggling terminals. There's air raid signals in Tel Aviv, other communities in central and southern Israel today. Israel's air defense system intercepting at least 15 rockets, the Israeli military saying other rockets hitting near Tel Aviv overnight. Israel's bombardment has killed at least 39 people in Gaza since Monday. That's reported by the Palestinian news agency. The heaviest fighting between Israel and the militant group Hamas since an eight-day battle in November of 2012. And here's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu earlier this week announcing plans to expand the military operation in response to the rocket attacks.
Israel is in the middle of an operation to return security to our region. We will not tolerate the firing of missiles on our cities. I have ordered a significant broadening of the army's operation against Hamas and the terrorists of other groups in the Gaza Strip.
An interpreter, obviously, Benjamin Netanyahu. Wayne Moyer, what is behind these latest tensions, this latest violence? Where is the escalation coming from?
Well, I think a lot of it came from the kidnapping, first of all, of the Israeli students who were hitchhiking back home from the West Bank, and then the reprisal killing, a revenge killing of a Palestinian by Israelis. And you have both Israelis and Palestinians very insecure about the other at this stage of the game. And sort of violence begets violence, and the escalation takes on a sort of a dynamic of its own. And each side then escalating, then the other side feels the necessity to respond, and it's not clear to me what stops this process from going further.
Jim McCormick, Israel has mobilized thousands of forces along the Gaza border for a possible ground invasion into the Palestinian territory. When was the last time that happened? That didn't turn out so well for Israel, did it?
Well, that was in, I guess, 2008 into 2009 when that, you know, had these kind of same rocket launches on each side and then these kind of efforts here on the part of the Israelis. I hope that there is some way to stop this violence. It really is. It's just really disheartening to read about this and the back and forth that the suffering that's going on and continuous rocket attacks actually by both sides that is taking place. And I guess I agree with Wayne. I'm not sure what will be able to sort of stop this. I mean, the Obama administration has called for restraint on the part of both sides, but you know, I'm not sure how much leverage we have with either party in this instance.
Is this a failure of the Obama administration's foreign policy, Jim?
Well, this has a long history, so I'm not sure you want to blame it on just one administration here. I mean, this has happened in other administrations as well. I suppose the failure overall to get a Middle East peace settlement is where I would place the blame.
Mm-hmm. Let me just add on this. The U.S. had this initiative, very recent initiative, on the part of Secretary Kerry to sort of broker a peace agreement. And while that initiative was going on, until it stopped, there wasn't much in the way of an escalation, that things were under control. So in some ways, the U.S. has tried to avoid this escalation.
Yeah, and I think one event happened that probably also figures into this kind of tinderbox, and that was that the Fatah government on the West Bank joined a kind of a coalition with Hamas in terms of having this unified government. And that was the thing that by April had sort of broke the back. I mean, the Kerry had said that he wanted to get some kind of agreement by the end of April of this year. And, of course, this event sort of stymied that effort.
Mm-hmm. What is at stake for us in the U.S.? Why should we, listening here in Iowa, care about that? We do, but why should we? This has been going on for decades. What is at stake?
Well, overall, what's at stake is the general stability of the Middle East. And underlying the general stability of the Middle East is, of course, access to the oil resources of the Middle East. If the price of oil skyrockets, it would have a very deleterious effect on the global economy.
Let's talk a little bit about Syria, developments there as well as part of this troubled area. Today, Syria's Western-backed opposition, the National Coalition, elected a new president after a three-day meeting in Istanbul. The United States and other key powers have designated this National Coalition as the main body representing the opposition to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Given that this coalition has little power inside Syria, how much significance is the naming of a president? What impact could this possibly have, Jim McCormick?
Well, I suppose it gives at least some solace to those forces fighting Assad eventually, you know, they're getting external support. I mean, one of the things that there's been the reluctance is to give much support to these Syrian opposition forces. But again, I think your point is well taken. I mean, how much is it really going to change the situation on the ground? The situation on the ground has been that Assad, particularly over the last year or so, has been very successful, and he's been fairly ruthless in terms of his activities against this opposition.
Mm-hmm. We've heard on NPR plenty of barrel bombs down, creating
Absolutely. Great
misery in those towns, not among combatants, but also civilians.
Let me take a slightly different angle on this. I think what we're trying to do is less focused on the Assad government, but more to put pressure on ISIS, which is creating all sorts of Al-Qaeda, not associated but similar group that's made all sorts of gains in Iraq. And maybe by adding a little pressure in Syria, you'll weaken its offensive in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. About this whole area, here's some of a speech in Oslo by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder this week, urging European partners to do more to find and disrupt plans of would-be terrorists who head to Syria. And the concern there is that Syria could become a cradle of terrorism. Jim, that must be our first and foremost concern here, that we have some area, another area on the planet that could be a cradle for terrorists visiting the U.S.
Yeah, I think Syria and this newly declared Islamic State, which is, you know, cross-border here with Iraq and Syria, is a real kind of danger here. And that is to ratchet up, it seems to me, the intelligence activities of the United States as well as its Western European allies. And some, at least over the last several days here, some activities have been done in terms of airport security, enhanced airport security, apparently that TSA is putting into effect, particularly for planes coming to the United States. But I think it really is an intelligence initiative, and probably what these comments really suggest is that there's got to be enhanced intelligence cooperation among the Western powers, as well as with the United States as well.
What do you see?
One of the things that I think that's really worrying people is radicalized Americans and Europeans traveling under European or American passports.
Right.
And that makes the domestic security problem really more complicated.
Okay, let's move on to a couple of other points, hot spots in the world, concerns for the U.S. The U.S. had hoped for a smooth transition of power in Afghanistan in the recent presidential elections to replace Hamid Karzai, evidently not to be. The trailing presidential candidate labeled preliminary results, quote, a coup against the people. Some supporters calling for the formation of a parallel government. Our Secretary of State, John Kerry, issuing a warning to the Afghans this week that if anyone tried to seize power in a rejection of early runoff results, international aid to Afghanistan would stop. So, Jim, is that our only lever here to help Afghanistan? Well, we hope on a road to democracy.
Well, we have assistance, of course, and we have obviously the presence of American military personnel, although both of these candidates have said that they would sign an agreement to maintain American military presence. So I suppose that could be an additional lever. But just the writing of this, that there are 3 million ballots that are in dispute, really doesn't give us solace about this electoral process, or more importantly, that even who is declared the winner, what kind of political base and what kind of political support that that leader will have. Maybe there can be, I mean, the other option would be, as we've tried to do in Iraq, is to have some kind of a coalition government, because the two candidates in Afghanistan have different political bases within the country, with the Pashtun and the Tajiks supporting each of these different candidates. So that might be one of the outcome, although that might be as difficult to pull off as we've tried to pull off with regard to Iraq.
Mm-hmm. President Hamid Karzai, leading Afghanistan for 12 years, concerns, especially with this news, about a power vacuum after he leaving office. Let's think about what could happen in a power vacuum. Wayne Moyer, could we see Afghanistan break apart, for instance?
Well, it could go back into a civil war situation. The Tajiks versus the Pashtuns, to some extent, that was the case before. But even if we didn't get back to that point, the lack of unity is going to weaken the resistance against the Taliban. And so this is very pernicious.
Mm-hmm. And the U.S.
I hope we can overcome it.
U.S., one aspect we haven't mentioned, U.S. also concerned that the election disputed here will delay the agreement. We want to keep some troops beyond 2014 in the country, but as you mentioned, that agreement is not finalized. That depends on this presidential election, right?
Yeah, the installation of the new president, I think, is the 2nd or 3rd of August. And until you get a new president, with Karzai refusing to sign the agreement, the deal with the United States can't be finalized.
Let's move to Ukraine. Ukrainian government troops making significant gains in recent days, pushing pro-Russian rebels out of a string of towns in the east, rebels retreating from Donetsk, Slovyansk. For weeks, those are powerful symbols to the resistance to Kiev. So, Jim, are Kiev's forces winning the conflict? Is this a turning point?
Well, with all of the bad news that we've been talking about over the last 50 minutes or so, I mean, this might be for the American foreign policy. This might be at least one sort of bright spot. I mean, it seems to me that Poroshenko has, you know, had this
the president of Ukraine.
That's right. Had this ceasefire for about a 10-day period, and now has gone on the offensive, and the Russians have seemingly pulled back. That is, that they have apparently been giving some small arms, but are not doing any more. And so it really does look like the centralized government here of Kiev is in better shape than it was even within the past few weeks here. Now, Poroshenko has argued for that he will, at his inaugural, have moved towards decentralization, talked about amnesty and so on, talked about no NATO involvement. So that, obviously, all of those things to the Russians are positive. I suspect the Russians, too, have decided that maybe some of these economic sanctions, and that they've got a Ukraine now that's more receptive to their interest. And one thing that's notable here is that the whole Crimea has been taken off the table. I mean, there's been a pro forma mention of it by the president, President Obama, that we won't stand for it, but really no action. So maybe that was really the ultimate Russian aim here.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, do you think it was really, as mentioned by Jim, possibly the economic sanctions by the West that has softened the Russian perspective here, changed its stance?
I certainly agree with Jim, and it's not only the economic sanctions, but the investment in Russia has declined, and the predictions for economic growth of Russia at this stage of the game for the next year are zero.
Yeah.
So clearly there's been a big economic impact. I think, and maybe following up on Jim, we may have the basis for a deal here. The West accepts the takeover of Crimea, and Putin pulls back from the eastern Ukraine. I hope that's the case. But that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Let's close with this. The New York Times reporting that I guess we can call this the latest edition, the second case of what we might call caught spying on your own best friends. The New York Times reporting that President Obama evidently did not know that a German intelligence officer had admitted leaking secrets to the CIA when he spoke to German Chancellor Angela Merkel last week, quoting from the New York Times. While Ms. Merkel chose not to raise the issue during the call, the fact that the president was kept in the dark about the blown spying operation at a particularly delicate moment in American relations with Germany has led frustrated White House officials to question who in the CIA's chain of command was aware of the case and why that information did not make it to the Oval Office before this call. Jim McCormick, your thoughts on this, the second case of...
Well, this is really stunning because, you know, every morning the president has the presidential daily brief. And that's supposed to be the summary from the intelligence community of these of activities around the world and trouble spots. It's really quite stark if, in fact, the intelligence community kept this from the president and so that he was not aware of that. That is really a problem in terms of administration, it seems to me. And so I'm quite stunned to hear this, that the president was not kept up to speed. And that may mean that some heads probably should roll here.
But this is, of course, a continuing problem with intelligence, which operates in secret. And how do you control a totally secret organization?
But if your president is speaking with the Chancellor of Germany, you need to know that a spy operation was blown, if she is aware of it as well.
Yeah, and there's questions here as to what extent the problem is in the White House, not with adequate links to the CIA, and to what extent the problem is within the CIA. We'll have to see how this works out.
You know, there's always this competition between the intelligence community and how much they want to share and how open they want to be with policymakers. And there really is that tension. I mean, there's lots of analysis done of this, or at least a fair bit of analysis done of this continuing competition of how much to share with policymakers and how much to ride herd on what they want to do. And this is not exactly a new problem, but it's a continuing problem.
Jim McCormick and Wayne Moyer, I'm looking at the calendar this morning preparing for this show. We see that we're 4 months away from midterm elections. I wanted to end this program by just asking if we see any defining issues emerging here, possibly immigration, maybe other issues that will dominate political conversation as we rev up and to head towards November. Wayne?
I see Obama's health care declining in importance. I see immigration maintaining its importance. Interestingly, the economy is doing well. To what extent the Democrats will be able to take advantage of that?
Yeah, to the extent that Obama and the Democrats will be given credit for it is another question as well. Jim McCormick, what's your read?
Well, I think, the litany of scandals that the Republicans want to put forward will really be part of our campaign ads that we see on television. I mean, that's what we're going to see in terms of whether it's the IRS or, you know, the Benghazi hearings will be in full swing by the fall. So I think some of those scandals from the Republican side will be what will be on our campaign.
So their narrative, this president, this party has been in power too long. It's time to change.
Well, and that they have not administered well, that there are these kind of continuous scandal and sort of the overarching theme of corruption. I think also this executive power issue might gain some traction, although not impeachment, but just the overreach by the administration, or at least that's going to be the claim in terms of executive power, might also be part of this. But I think immigration is going to be there, particularly if this refugee immigration problem continues, as it's likely to.
Wayne Moyer, any other thing? Further thought? A few seconds here.
I can't think of anything else right off.
Okay,
the top
okay,
of my
okay.
Head.
We will continue these conversations. Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's been a delight, Wayne Moyer and Jim McCormick. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor of political science at Grinnell College. As I said, always a delight to have your insights on our latest developments on the political landscape. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you'd like to hear this program, perhaps you caught part of it, want to hear the whole hour, all of our talk shows are put online after the fact for you to listen to as podcasts or streaming. If you'd like to find those, simply go to iowapublicradio.org. Look for River to River under our news section. I'll be away tomorrow. Ben Stanton will be standing in for me tomorrow in this chair, I think, to talk about Supreme Court rulings recently. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.